plus 01, say O naught plus 01 E over MR plus higher orders, right? And so what we're doing, and the assumption is that you got, you know, M here, and then these are your energies down here in energy space. So to organize that, what we're doing is we're just taking some random scale and lambda, and the assumption is that lambda is much bigger than E, but also that it's much less than M, and that's possible because E was much less than M. So we know that exists. There's some sort of lambda we can choose.
Lambda can go very, you know, close to MR. Yes.
Well, the closer it gets, the worse it gets, in the sense that, in the way that I'm about to quantify. So
there's the theory works. The effective theory works.
It depends on what you mean by works. So, because the thing is that, you remember, all the nice things are happening when we do a Taylor expansion of 1 over M. Because in general, you can define the Wilson action, and it's just, it exists, but it's a non-local thing. And so it all becomes a nice local thing once we start Taylor expanding everything in terms of 1 over M. So then it's a question of, if both these things are small compared to 1 over to M, then we can always do that expansion. But if these guys are close, then you worry that you can expand in this ratio, but there's going to be terms that are involving this ratio, which is not small, and then what do you do with that? So where I'm going is I'm about to leave this formulation with lambda, because everybody sets it up in this way because it's a very physical way. You know, you're kind of integrating these guys out and you're following what they do at low energies. But in practice, when you're actually doing something, the existence of a scale like lambda is actually, it's not really worth it, because it complicates all the, when you're trying to quantify how the M's appear, it looks like there's, you know, if you tried to have lambda be closer to M, it looks like you're making life complicated for yourself, whereas really the theory doesn't care what lambda is. So there can't be that anything depends on lambda over M, because nothing depends on lambda. But it could be that at intermediate steps, you might find things that are depending on lambda over M. And so the program will be, we're gonna set all this up in a way where we don't have lambda explicitly anymore. And then we'll just define theories above and below the thresholds. And we'll talk about it as if we're here, but in practice, when we calculate, it'll be calculating observables as functions of some low energy quantity, which we'll never allow to be here. If we did put it here, then we'd have all these problems of the theories exist but doesn't do much for us, because it's got an infinite number of terms that we have to keep track of. But we won't have to ever talk about lambda at that point. So it's mostly there conceptually to set the problem up, but then in practice we're not going to use it much. And it's dangerous, because the literature is full of effective field theory talk, and it's all... And normally what happens is you don't know what's going on up here, so you're just dealing with some theory, and there's a scale lambda you don't understand. And so then what people do is they think of lambda as being somehow a proxy for M. But they don't know what M is, because they don't know what the full theory is. You can fall into traps that way, because if you do a calculation and you track how, in the low energy theory, and you track how it depends on lambda, what you're normally doing is you're assuming that if you had the full theory, what you found is telling you something about how the answer would have depended on some big scale M, if you knew what that theory was. And it's not always true that it does. So there's I'll get to that later on, but if I calculate some observable and it depends on lambda, say it goes like log of lambda or something, then there's a very precise way in which I can calculate something, how things depend on log lambda down here, and that will tell me how the full theory would have depended on log of M. And so that's kind of why people have this intuition that lambda is kind of telling you something about M. But if I did the same thing for powers of lambda, then I'll show you also that doesn't work. If you just say dimensional statements, like if I have powers of lambda, then I should also expect powers of M, those will be true. And on dimensional grounds, they'll appear in similar ways. But if you try and say that the coefficient of the lambda squared term in something is 6, and then think that that's telling you the coefficient of the M squared term is 6, then you'll be wrong. And so sometimes people do that, because if you said the coefficient of the log lambda term is 6, then it would have been true that the coefficient of the log M term is also 6. And because people have experience with that, they often make wrong statements about powers of lambda. And so it's important to keep in mind that they're conceptually different. Okay. All right, so...
Another question. Yeah, it's okay. About J. You know, that J...
Yeah, the curly J.
Yes, curly J. Yeah. So which parameter in J is responsible for, you know, that, you know, J doesn't talk to the higher energy modes?
It's when you chose J, you're choosing a configuration, so you're letting it vary. So supposing you decompose the J, suppose the way you specifies J was to specify its Fourier components. Then the rule is that when you're specifying J, the Fourier components only involve long wavelength components.
So I think that this way J depends on lambda.
Yeah, it does, and this is the way it depends on it.
So when you put J equals zero, then you're sure that the theory is lambda independent.
Well, that's not the only lambda dependence, but J does depend on lambda. But lambda is also appearing elsewhere in the calculation.
Yeah, I know, but you didn't talk about that J. You don't just lambda dependence on other parts of the path integral. But still, J depends on lambda, and so at the end, if J does not vanish, then maybe the path integral depends on lambda.
Well, it depends on exactly what you mean now. So if you're talking about the whole path integral, then that doesn't depend on lambda, because we started with a path integral that had no lambdas in it, and we put lambda in by saying that we'll just do the integral to here, and then we'll do it from here. But it's just a bookmark, right?
Yes.
So from that point of view, nothing depends on lambda. But if you're talking about the part of the exercise where we're going from here to here, say, then you might say, well, so maybe the answer depends on lambda to that point, say. And part of that will come in through J, that's true. And so the first part of your question was, so how do you specify what J is? How do you specify that it only sees low energies? And so when I imagine, when you're specifying J, what you're doing is you're specifying a whole bunch of different functions of X. And then you're asking, what's this action as a function of all of those things? And so a different way of specifying it could have been, what's your, instead of giving a function of X, you give me functions of momentum. And so the statement would be that you can think of functions of momentum, but they can't, the momentum involved is always less than lambda, is the way that would come in for the current. That would be one way of specifying the current. Or in position space, you could just say that the function is varying physically, it's not varying quickly, it's only varying on distances that are large compared to 1/lambda, how you'd say that in position space. And the details of how you do that, there's many ways you can do that, and it doesn't matter what the details are, as long as you've got something which is discriminating between the very short wavelengths and the very long wavelengths. And the details will tell you a lot about what's happening precisely here, but in the end of the day, because all those details are canceling, because lambda's not in the answer, it's not going to really matter how you set it up. So we're going to set it up in a particularly convenient way.
In the whole path integral, there's J.
Yes. Yeah.
So you have constraint on J, that J only talks to lower energy modes.
Yeah.
So that means that J depends on lambda.
Oh, you're talking now, so...
Because of this new constraint on J.
Yeah, no. So that I agree with that.
So
yeah.
The whole path integral depends on lambda.
Oh, that's where you're going. You want to argue that the answer depends on lambda. Although it's true that I stick lambda in, you want to argue that the answer depends on lambda because I'm choosing to look at things that are slowly varying compared to lambda. And in some sense, that's true. But that's I could have phrased that in terms of M, right? Because originally we had, supposing you say it in terms of W, right? So W was a function of, in the original theory, of J and J, right? This is coupling to the heavy guy, and this is coupling to the light guy. And then I, from that, was getting what we called, curly W of J, which was, we were just restricting our attention to these J's that were varying slowly, and this guy was zero, right? And so in the physical problem, when I say J is varying slowly, what I mean is I'm going to choose things that are small compared to this, to capital M. So I want J to be varying on scales that I'm probing. So if I'm interested in energies that are 10 to the minus 10 of M, J will involve things that are down here. And so for the purposes of setting up the path integral, I'm phrasing that in terms of lambda, because I want to do things in two steps. But it's the low energy, the real low energy, the thing that has to be going on to make everything work is that this scale has to be much smaller than this scale, because that's what simplified the real answer. And we're just using lambda as a way to get at the easy part of that calculation.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on you. So the thing is, if you want, it's all driven, as you'll see when we get there, if you want to know the accuracy of your answer to one part in 10 to the 10, and you think that there's contributions in that coming from 1/E/m, then you have to have this be 10 to the minus, the question would be, if you want to work to order 10 to the minus 10, and say this ratio is 10 to the minus 4, then you have to work to second order in this ratio.
Okay.
So it's just kind of all relative to you know, in the end of the day, you're doing a series in this ratio, and that's a bad or a good series depending on how small the ratio is. So if it's a really, really small ratio, then you don't have to go down the series very far. If it's a large ratio, then it's actually not a very good way to organize your calculation.
Can you guarantee the series not asymptotic or anything?
Oh, almost always it is.
Oh, yeah.
In this particular case, it might not be, but it's but if it is, it doesn't bother me. normally you would know that the it may be that in the energy expansion you can say something more. You know, perturbation theory and coupling constants almost always is asymptotic. It's almost never converging. The domain of the convergence is zero essentially, as far as so and that doesn't really bother me. And this, you might be able to say more about the energy dependence, but I'm not sure what the clean statement is. But if it was asymptotic, it wouldn't bother me. So it's yeah. All right, so.
The last question. So, still have a problem with gamma. So, if gamma plays a role of the true quantum action, but gamma is absolutely different from the classical action B. So,
You're talking about gamma for the full theory or for the.
Yeah, for the full theory.
Okay.
So, you know, at the beginning of the problem, we assume that, you know, there is a classical. You know, everything is classical, and then we started perturbation around the minimum of the potential. Yes.
Okay. Well, we didn't actually do that. We perturbed around some random configuration, I turned the current on to make that configuration solve the equations of motion, basically.
So, just if you think that we want to, you know, perturb around the minimum of the vacuum, okay. So at the end,
that would be J equals zero, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And so it seems that after a lot of, you know, perturbating things, then gamma will be absolutely different from the V, the classical field that we had at the beginning.
And you're thinking because the quantum effects are changing.
So, you know, at first we thought that maybe the quantum effects are not very important because, you know, this is our intuition about the quantum effects.
Yeah.
But at the end, it seems that everything will change, and then the gamma is absolutely different from V. So for example, so this is my question, that for Mexican hat,
yeah.
So how does the potential change after we include all the quantum corrections?
You want a plot of it or something?
For example.
Well, you know, there's two issues here. So one of them is the answer can't be too different from what you started with in the regime where you thought it was well described by the series, right? So in our case, in the toy model case, it was when the fields were of the order of 1 over lambda, the little lambda, the coupling constant, square root of little lambda. So in that field regime, you know, a check on the sensibility of the whole thing would be if you did the series calculation, the potential should be differing by things that are powered as lambda, so it shouldn't be differing much. And that's what you'll find is that, you know, the corrections are there. If it happens that you're looking at something which was zero to zeroth order, it might be that it's the usual thing with a series that if you get a series and you find that the second term is as big as the first term, then either your series goes going bad because the thing you're expanding in is not small, or it happened that the first term by accident was zero or something. So then the next term was the dominant thing. So all those things you have to think through here. And so it should be true that when you calculate gamma, if it is true that you're in the semi-classical approximation, then gamma and S will be very close to each other, and the corrections will be small. So
at the end, if we include all the quantum corrections, can we see the Mexican hat form, in the potential?
Well, in this case, it was already there classically, right? The classical potential had the Mexican hat in it, and then the quantum corrections didn't change it by much if lambda was small. And in the field range where phi was of the order of 1 over root lambda, so that's the large field range. That's for small fields, there's a slightly more complicated story to talk about. But that's not the region where you thought that the semi-classical approximation was one that should be giving you the right story. So if you're in the domain of validity of your approximation, which is why I'm phrasing this in terms of things like lambda, not h-bar. Often this is expressed as a series in 1 over h-bar, but I'm using units where h-bar is 1. So what does that mean? So really the issue is you're trying to find a small dimensionless parameter in your problem, which is controlling the size of the action, making the action large, essentially, in the path integral. And then if you're in the regime where that parameter is small, then the series makes sense and you can calculate things and the corrections will be small. But it's not guaranteed that someone hands you a theory that you're in the regime where the semi-classical approximation is a good one. And so then it's not small and you have to figure out some other way to calculate it. The issue with small fields is there's often you hear there's several issues, but one of them is you can prove that the effective action, the way I'm effective potential, the way I'm defining it, is convex in the sense that, you know, if I take any two, it can never have a hill in it. Between any two points that are on the potential, you know, I can draw a chord, and the potential had to always be under that. And so there's an issue as to the physical interpretation when you have a Mexican hat of what the energy would be, and that's kind of partly to do with the small field not being the semi-classical story. And part of that issue is that when we do the calculation for the potential, what we normally do is we choose the background field configuration to be constant because we're looking at the potential and not the derivative terms. But when you have a Mexican hat kind of a thing, what can happen is that the energetically favorable situation might be to have a bubble of one region. So to have a inhomogeneous configurations might be the ones that are the most energetically favorable. If I specify an average value of the field, but I'm trying to minimize the energy with a Mexican hat, it might be worthwhile having it be at the minimum, the real minimum for most of space, but then to make an excursion somewhere to a higher part of the potential such that the average didn't change. And so in those configurations where you have non-homogeneous field configurations are the ones that are the optimal ones, what will happen is that the energy, if you calculate the potential by forcing the field to be constant, you're not going to get the minimum energy in the problem, because there was another configuration where the fields were varying, which had lower energy, and you didn't see that because you assumed that things were constant configurations. And so that convexity is usually to do with that, that the when people prove things are convex, they're proving that the minimum energy subject to an average value of the field is a convex function. And that doesn't mean that the classical potential was convex or the potential evaluated, restricted to constant fields is convex. Because what's really happening is that it's like in thermodynamics, the Maxwell construction, right? If you have a free energy that has two minima and you're at a field configuration between the two minima, what you really like to do if your field is there is to have an admixture of domains which are in the first minimum and another admixture in the other minimum, and you balance them in such a way that you can stay at that. You know, if you have a free energy like this, and I have so here's a field, and here's energy. And if I want to have a field here, naively you would say that I have to have this energy. But a way I can have this energy is to have domains. You know, if this is A and this is B, have domains where here the field is at A, here the field is at B, and there's some gradient energy you'll have to pay in between. But if I make these domains sufficiently large, and that gradient energy might be negligible. And so then the thing I might like to be at here is to have the world half A and half B, rather than having the world everywhere zero, at phi equals zero. And so the convexity statements are normally statements like that, that the minimum of your energy is something which is not a homogeneous function. And so if you assumed it was homogeneous, you're tracking a different function than the minimum energy would have been. And so it's not the same as this issue of the semi-classical approximation at small fields, but there's a subtlety going on there that you have to track that the quantum action is a statement about the energy subject to an average field, and you have to be careful what that average meant. And in particular, particularly particle physics, we have kind of translation invariance built into our bones, and so this kind of thing is easy to not think about. Okay, we good? All right. So the story so far has been that we have this expression for this effective thing. And we're getting it as, you know, we had heavy things, we had light things. So we had this general so curly J was the thing that was related to gamma by that. And then the idea was we can do this, the heavy part of the integral once and for all, because it's not appearing in J. And so if we had done that, all right, it's over here. If we'd done that, we could have written this thing as the, yeah, what we would have called the, sorry, L, Wilson action. Where e to the I Wilson action is just this integral, which we could do once and for all. So schematically, that's the thought, that we're trying to do the heavy part of the integral once and for all, very beginning of the calculation, take advantage of any profit we get by expanding in 1 over the heavy scale, right at the very beginning, and then that'll make life easy. And then once we've done that, if we call the answer this, it's going to turn out that this is behaving exactly like what we would have called a classical action. So if someone walked in and saw this formula, he would have said, oh yeah, that's the classical action, and this is the usual thing that you use to get the generating functional. But we know that really this was something which came to us from some higher thing. But the interesting thing, the interesting thing that's behind all this is that something defined in this way has all the properties we would have demanded of a classical action. It'll be real, it will be the integral over space-time of some local thing, once we've done the expansion of powers of 1 over m, because in that limit, the uncertainty principle is essentially making all the non-locality of propagating of heavy things into local things that are happening at some spot. They were heavy. To produce them, you had to violate energy conservation. You can only do that if you're fast, because of the uncertainty principle, so things happen at times that are very close together, and that makes things local. And so that means that's the modern way of thinking about classical Lagrangians, is that it's just some thing you got by integrating out the still smaller things that you're not looking at. We closed last class with a kind of an explicit in the toy model case calculation of how you would, you know, how this would kind of work out, which I just want to remind you of, but we won't come, you know, we're not going to use it in detail. So in the toy model where our Lagrangian was minus let me write it down the way I wrote it down last time. So it's minus 1/2 d mu chi d mu chi minus 1/2 1 plus chi over 2 root 2 v squared d mu xi d mu xi minus v of chi, where v was lambda over 4 root 2 v chi plus chi squared over 2 squared. So we were expanding in powers of lambda, and we were kind of going through the exercise of calculating. This guy had a mass, this guy was massless, and we were calculating what the effective action was. So if we calculated the graphs in gamma of C, if you like, at tree level we had things like, and that gave us, actually, let me draw the graph down here, where the solid line was a chi and the dotted line was a xi. That gave us things like d mu xi, d mu xi squared with some coefficient a. And a turned out to be, from evaluating this graph, it was something like lambda, lambda over 4 mr squared. And then we looked at but that was also, if we calculated, I need a little bit more room in this board. If I did the same thing for the Wilson action, we had actually the same kind of a contribution here at the tree level. We knew that in general, classically, let me call this A hat or something, or A Wilson. So this graph contributed the same thing to both of these guys. So it contributed A was equal to lambda over 4 MR squared, and it contributed AW was the same thing. And in the classical approximation, this path integral, or the remaining path integral, I guess, this one, was a silly one, because the effectively we got we could think of this as being a Feynman, having a Feynman rule. So the Feynman rule for that vertex is, it's something which looked like that, whose coefficient was A. And we were supposed to think of that as, you know, pictorially, it was like what was really going on was the exchange of something heavy. But this was happening on a very short distance, so we couldn't see it because we weren't looking at sufficiently high energies to resolve it. So this whole thing was being shrunk down to what was looking like an effective interaction. But then this whole formalism was just kind of silly in the sense that this would be the way we're calculating this particular thing. And then this part of the integral was just a silly calculation that we were just doing the graph, essentially that graph, and finding that the gamma was equal to the Wilson action, which is always true at the classical level. It only got interesting at the loop level, and so there were a whole bunch of loops we could look at, one of which I focused on, like that one. And that had several interesting regimes, because there's a loop integral in here. So we had an integral d4l going on. And there were different, the way you thought of this graph being divided up, that's a graph in the full theory. The way you thought of it being divided up into this and into this was to do with how much momentum is going around that graph. So if we wrote that integral as integral from 0 to lambda, d4l of whatever we were integrating, plus the integral from lambda to infinity, d4l of whatever we're integrating, this part of it was this part of the story, where we're integrating over the light degrees of freedom, and this part of it was this part of the story, where we're integrating over the heavy degrees of freedom. And in this pictorial language, what I'm hoping to, so if I write out pictorially, if I think of this guy, everybody's at high energy, so everybody in this whole loop is at high energy, so the distances between here, 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 and here are all short, because that's all the uncertainty principle saying that nothing's gone very far. So in the low energy theory, that just looks like something with, something happens at a point with four things coming out of it, so very much like this. So this part of it gave us another piece, which was, say, delta A, d mu xi, d mu xi. And so pictorially that was, if everybody's at the high energies, that's actually in the Wilson action. So that's here. We have d mu xi, d mu xi, with some coefficient delta A. And it was something which is proportional to lambda squared over 4m squared, because it was a one loop higher contribution to the same interaction. So this was something going like lambda squared over m to the fourth. I guess I'm calling it MR. So that was like a similar thing here, that we had, on the one hand, we started off with the whole picture, and the high frequency part of it, that whole thing got shrunk down to a point. But this part of it was something which was not like that. In that case, these guys were heavy, so they were short, but this guy wasn't heavy, because this was this is heavy because even though the momentum is small here, the mass is large, so the energy is always high. Here, the momentum is small, then because the mass is also small, the energy is small. So these guys don't have to be close to each other. So the way to think about this, the way that graph fit into this picture was that I should think of that as being so now this is the case where L is less than lambda. I should think of that as being really something like this. So these guys were shrinking down into something small. And what was that small thing? It was the same thing we'd done before. It's that small thing. It's this particular small thing. So what's appearing here should be A, if we call this A tree, whereas A tree plus this would be A one loop, say. And so thinking of this part of the graph this way, what's happening is that this part of the graph is being done here, and it's just giving a one loop correction to an effective interaction in the Wilson action, and we're changing its coefficient by something proportional to the coupling constant, but it's still something which has four external phi lines and two derivatives in it. Whereas this graph, the low energy part of this graph, which I'm thinking of in this way, I should think of as being at the process of going from here to here. So this tree level process gave me a vertex in the Wilson action, which looked like this vertex here. And then when I did this integral, I'm doing a non-trivial graph. Instead of just doing this graph, which is the classical result, now we have also this graph. And this graph would be another graph like this one. But let me use a square here rather than a dot just to distinguish it. So the Feynman rule for this could be, if you like, a tree. The Feynman rule for this is, you know, involves a tree squared. And the Feynman rule for this would give you delta A. Well, you actually do, because if you didn't, and you were just calculating this because you're the person who walked in the room and said, oh, there's the classical action, there's the quantum calculation, you would have said, well, here's the tree level classical thing, here's the loop thing, but it's diverging. It's going like integral d4p of, you know, whatever. And we showed that goes like lambda to the fourth in the loop. And so you would have said, oh, that's diverging. So that's an ultraviolet divergence. I'm supposed to renormalize that. I need some sort of a lambda dependence in my coupling constants. And so I'll stick one in. I'll say, well, what I used to think of as A, I'll think of as A plus a lambda dependent thing. And then I'll perturb in that lambda dependent thing, which gives me a new counterterm of Feynman rule. And then you would have said that the lambdas here cancel the lambdas here. And that's what the renormalization prescription was. And so this is where that came from. it was actually there all the time. And it came from the high frequency part of the definition of the action. So it's not something you have to do. It's done for you for free. But if you didn't see this part of the calculation before you saw this part, you'd say, and you didn't know that this was true, you'd say, oh, I'm just calculating the way I calculate, and I have to kind of keep adjusting the constants to make it all not depend on lambda. And it looks crazy, but really it's just because you missed part of the story. So those counterterms are really just part of the graph that was there in the full theory, if you had the full theory. It's just that often the way we approach problems, we don't have the full theory, we just have the low energy part of it, and we don't know what these were. But if you did know what the full theory was, you could calculate them, and they would be whatever they had to be, because lambda is not in the answer. So this is what we would have called a counterterm. Yeah.
I'm going off tangent, but how does a mathematician or a physicist ever know that the theory is full?
Is what?
It's full.
What's it mean to be full?
Well, you were talking about it looks crazy, but really because you're missing part of the theory. What is there to ensure a human mind that the mind has the full picture?
Would you mind if I answer that at the end of the class? Because that's the kind of thing that we could spend the whole day talking about. But if you don't mind, I'm happy to address it. But it'd be best if we address it offline. So at 10:30, I got nothing to do, and I'm happy to talk about that. Okay. So that's kind of what the story was. But I'm going to now say, don't ever do this, because this is hard. Because you have to, the cutoffs are there. You're tracking something which is, you know, you're tracking something which is a big dimension in your lambda is bigger than the scale E. And when you do dimensional analysis, it's going to want to, if you kind of ask to estimate how big this graph was, the answer you get is that it's basically lambda to the fourth, you know, a squared lambda to the fourth over mr, I guess, to the eighth. No, I guess a squared takes care of that. So the, this looks like, if you estimated how big this answer was, it looks like it's actually dominated by the lambda dependence, which is irrelevant to everything. So it's not an efficient way to carry things around, because you're really trying to track the E's over the M's. So this is what you would call integrating out. But what I want to emphasize is what we're going to really do is matching. So what we'll do is we'll say that we know that this is working. And so the smart thing to do is to say, well, that means that there will exist a Wilson action that will describe everything, order by order in one over M. So let's just guess that action. So we know this thing has to look like a classical action. It's going to be real. It's got to be Lorentz invariant if we're doing a Lorentz invariant problem. It's going to be local. It's a polynomials of the fields and derivatives that are all evaluated at the same spot, because that's what happened when we expanded in powers of one over M. Let's just write down the most general thing we can write down that's consistent with everything we know at low energies, and then organize where the one over M's are appearing there, and that'll be dimensional analysis. And then say, we have a whole bunch of unknown coefficients of all these interactions. Let's fix those by demanding that that this theory reproduces the full theory for some as many observables as we need to determine the parameters we don't know. And then once we've done that, we're done. And then we have the Lagrangian, we can calculate anything else we like with it. And that avoids this exercise of ever going through in detail this kind of a splitting up of the graphs to a certain extent. But it's a much more efficient way to approach the problem, because you're not trying to show every time that this Lagrangian is going to exist. And so that takes it, so that the topic I really want to talk about is what you need to do to do this matching program. That's called matching, where you guess what the Wilson action is, and you compare it to the full theory for some observables to figure out the interactions of the Wilson action, and then you use that for whatever else you want to do. That process is called the matching process. And so to carry that out, you need to know what is a good guess for the Lagrangian. How many terms do you have to go down in the expansion of powers of fields and derivatives to know that you've got enough to any fixed order in one over M? And once, not only that, once you have that Lagrangian, you want to know, what graphs do I have to draw? Do I have to worry about 15,000 loop graphs? You know, you want to know in advance that to calculate to some fixed order in 1 over M, I have to have these terms in the Lagrangian, and I have to do these graphs and no more. And that will give me the whole answer to that order in 1 over M. And so that's the process of identifying what the interactions are and which graphs they appear in is called power counting. It's going to be dimensional analysis with an overlay of kind of experience with how these graphs, Feynman graphs, work. So that's where I want to go. The goal is, how do you characterize the Lagrangian, and then how do you characterize which graphs are appearing in that Lagrangian? Yeah.
So from the description you've given, it sounds like, how does this differ from adding counterterms to your Lagrangian? Because from what you described, very basically, you count terms that are going to have the same dimension mass, and then you
You're talking about the thing I'm about to do, or the thing?
Yeah, the thing.
Let me do it first, and then re-ask it at that point. Because otherwise, I'll be telling you what I think I'm going to do, and then I'll then do it. Then I'll tell you afterwards what I did. And but it's a good question, because in the end, it's going to be essentially be the short version would be. It depends very much if you know what the full theory is or not. If you just know the light theory, if someone just hands you a Lagrangian and says that's the effective theory for something, which is effective what people always do when they hand you a Lagrangian, they're not saying they know everything there is to know about everything. They're saying, I think this is relevant for this physics at this energy. And so implicit in that assumption is that there's physics at shorter distances that they don't think is important. So they're assuming it's a long ways away. So when they've done that, if all you have is that, then you don't really know what the full theory is, and so there's nothing to match to. And so what you would then do is you'd learn the values of the Lagrangian from experiments, and then effectively you would see the need for these things when comparing to experiments, because you know the experiments don't depend on how you define these integrals, and that would be the counterterm story. But if you have the full theory, then you can do better than that, because the counterterms are kind of coming to you in a more systematic way. So the lesson of that is that it's not so much that this is you shouldn't be anchoring this with counterterms. This is what anchors counterterms. When you're doing the counterterm story, this is why it made sense. Okay, so we want to do matching. As opposed to integrating out. So this is not universally the use of the language, but I'm kind of thinking of this being integrating out, where I just do the integrals and I do what I do and I cut things off. And this is this process of guessing the Lagrangian because you know it had to exist and then identifying its coefficients by comparing to observables. So the program is to guess the most general form for the Wilson action, which we'll assume to be local. So it's some Lagrangian built out of the light fields. And we're going to, we only really know that this answer should have been local if we had been doing a series in 1 over the mass from the experience with the integrating out. So what we want to do is we want to organize the terms in this Lagrangian in powers of 1 over the mass. So that means we should be thinking of it as the important fact that's going to happen is that on dimensional grounds, you can imagine adding more and more powers of fields and derivatives. And the important fact is that they all, on dimensional grounds, the more fields and derivatives you have, the more 1 over m's you need. And so that will be the simplifying organizing feature, that if you're working to some fixed order in 1 over m, there's a limit to how complex your answer can be. But let me get there in a second. And if you're worried about what's being compared to m, it's in practice in the Lagrangian going to be derivatives or fields. So powers of say L over M and or right. Actually, there's actually a logical distinction here. So we're going to always ask for the derivatives to be small compared to M. And we may choose to ask for the fields to be small. So, but not necessarily. So the issue here will be, if I have some reason that I know what the field dependence is, and field dependence, if large fields do not cost a lot of energy, then they should be in the low energy theory. And if I have some reason for understanding, some symmetry reason, say, for understanding what the dependence is on that field, I don't need to do a Taylor expansion as functions of it. And so it may be that I have situations where I'm not interested in doing an expansion of powers of fields. But derivatives are normally sampling the energies and the momenta in the process, so you normally don't have an option with derivatives being small. But in practice, in most applications, they're both small, because for most potential energies, once the fields become large, the potentials get large, and then the energies are large, and then you're no longer at low energies. So this caveat not necessarily was to do with if you have very flat potentials where large fields do not cost a lot of energy. You may have another way of thinking about that. So this is step one, and then fix the unknown coefficients of interactions by demanding the observables agree with the full theory order by order in 1 over m. And I guess in this case it'd be the whatever the variable like energy is that you're comparing to m in the observables. MR, yeah.
In powers of, and then it looks like die over MR.
Derivatives over MR.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're going to get powers of fields in the derivatives, and then the message is that derivatives cost you powers of 1 over M, and fields also tend to cost you powers of 1 over something. But they're logically different, and the issue is whether or not more field means more energy. I'm gonna come to that in a second. Yeah. So the question that'll be the first question is how do you decide what the dimensions are? So where I'm going is first that. So how do you organize where the 1 over m's would go in the Lagrangian? So we at least we know how they we are what does it mean here to organize things in powers of one over M and the Lagrangian? But then the second step, which is a step that people often don't take, is to ask, given the Lagrangian has powers of one over M, how do those things appear in graphs? So if I have a graph involving L loops and E external lines, how many powers of one over M are appearing in an observable given where they appeared in the Lagrangian? That's the power counting part of it. So part A will be, so for one, what we have to do is we have to do a dimensional analysis of L. And for part two, we have to do a power count, which means track how 1 over M appears in graphs. Or if you're not using graphical methods, whatever your way of calculating is, use that. And the question is, how do the 1 over M's appear in your calculational scheme? Okay, so let's do part one first. So, and this is something which you're probably doing all the time anyway, and it's so you won't be surprised by anything I'm going to say here. So dimensional analysis. Remember, the starting point is that we're interested in doing integrals of e to the I action. And that made sense if the action was dimensionless, but you know from classical mechanics that the action is the integral d time of the Lagrangian. And for us, the Lagrangian is the integral over space of something else, so we write that as the integral d4x of some Lagrangian density. And you know that it has dimensions, because the Lagrangian is normally the kinetic minus the potential energy. So that has dimensions of energy, and this is energy times time. So this has got dimensions of energy times time. What did this mean? Well, there was an implicit h-bar in here, right? Because h-bar also has dimensions of energy times time, and that was the thing that was appearing in the path integral. But I'm using units where h-bar is 1, and so that's part of the story here. Is for dimensional analysis, it's very convenient to use units where h-bar is 1. It's also convenient to use units where c is 1 if you're in relativistic theories, where the speed of light is 1. If you're doing finite temperature, it's useful to have the Boltzmann constant 1, because these are units choices at some level. These are fundamental constants. Everybody agrees on their value. And this is really just telling you how to convert a degree Kelvin into an electron volt, if you like. So it tells you how to convert temperature to energy. This is telling you how to convert distance to length. If you are very good at measuring time, which we are, frequencies are easy to measure, we measure distances as how far light goes in that amount of time. And everybody agrees on that because everybody agrees on what the speed of light is, which wouldn't have been obvious to Newton, but it's because Einstein tells us that everybody agrees on that number, we can use that as our distance measure. And then h-bar is telling us how to convert time into frequency, into energy. So if we have a given energy, you know, an electron volt turns into, is a converts into, you know, the number I always remember is that a 10 to the minus 23 seconds is like a Fermi. If you use C equals 1, and that's like 100 MeV in terms of energy. And so these guys are just really units choices. And with these choices, everything is an energy, or everything's a length, or everything's a time, or everything's mass, because I can get from one to the other just by using factors of K, H bar, and C. So I want to use energy. So we'll imagine that everything can be written as dimensions of everything, it will be powers of energy. So let's write, if you give me some quantity, Q for quantity, the square brackets around Q will mean the dimensions of Q are energy to the power. So if I say that Q is equal to, square bracket around Q is equal to P, that's code for the dimension, the engineering dimension of Q is energy to the P. You know, your convention could have been that it was, we were going to use length to the something, in which case it would be 1 over, it'd be minus P. And if someone gives you something like Q is a temperature, then what you're supposed to really do is think that, well, I put in the factors of H bar C and K to make it equal to an energy, and then I think, what was the dimensions and powers of energy? So I'm not writing these things because you can always put them in by making the dimensions right. So in that language, H bar was 1. So that's going to be, that's energy to the nothing. That's energy times time, but energy is like 1 over time in these units. So in that language, the action, which has the same dimensions as h-bar, is dimensionless. So the action So for example, the action S has dimension 0. It's dimensionless, you know, when h bar is equal to 1. In the units for which h bar is equal to 1, the action will be dimensionless. And so we also know from that what the dimensions of L are. So so remember, d4x came to us as d4x is dt d3x. So that's time length cubed. But up to factors of c and h bar, that's also, you know, the dimensions of this. That's really like, I could think of this as being time to the fourth if I put in factors of c to convert distance to time, or this is length to the fourth if I put in factors of c to make time into the distance. And length is like 1 over energy. And so the dimension of this is going to be energy to the minus 4 because it's length to the fourth. And so given that that's true and that this is dimensionless, that tells us that the Lagrangian density is dimensions of energy to the fourth. And that's clearly a dimension that's true in four, because we had three space dimensions in one time. If we had been living in 10 dimensions, then L would have had dimensions of energy to the 10th. So one exercise you can do, when I'm finished organizing things, you'll see that there's a divide between things that become important at low energies and things that are not important at low energies. And that divide is the dimension dependent. It depends on the number of space-time dimensions in a way that you can track by repeating the exercise I'm about to do, but not in four dimensions. Did you have a question? No? OK. So we're in the business of trying to write down, you know, we're trying to guess a Wilson Lagrangian, and we'd like to know what are the dimensions of the coefficients appearing in that Lagrangian, because we're going to think that if we find a coupling constant which has got dimensions of energy to some power in the Wilson Lagrangian, that's probably, the energy involved is probably going to be this heavy M that we're trying to track. And because the Wilson Lagrangian came by integrating out only the heavy stuff. And so we haven't done the light integrals yet, so we haven't had a chance for them to feed into any of the things we're calculating. So so to pin that down, let's write down some, to know what the dimensions of the coefficients in the Lagrangian are, we need to know what the fields are, or the derivatives are in the Lagrangian. So let me just write down some examples of fields and derivatives. And we might as well start with this, with our toy model, right? In our toy model, we had minus 1 half d mu xi, d mu xi. And then we had things like, what else did we have? Things like chi. Let's start with this, actually, plus other terms. As soon as we write down something like this in our Lagrangian, which is what we had, for instance, for chi, and what we also had in the very top here, if we take the one term here, we're making a statement as to what the dimensions of xi are. Because derivatives, you know, d mu is just, that's just d dx mu. So x is a length, so d mu is 1 over length. So that says that the derivatives, the dimensions of a derivative are 1. It's an energy, or 1 over length, or 1 over time, depending on which derivative it was. And so if this thing, you know, if that's equal to 4, and the derivatives are, you know, is equal to 2, is equal to 1, and this derivative has dimension 1, then the rest of the powers have to come from xi. And so it has to be true that the missing dimensions here, this is so far going like energy squared from the derivatives, the whole answer had to be energy to the fourth. The coefficient is a half, which has no dimension. So that means that we're learning that the dimension of the field has to also be 1 to make the dimensions work here. So that would mean that once we write down a kinetic term like this, we're saying that the dimensions of the fields have dimensions of energy or mass. So you might have said, well, so if that's true, let me say it in a second here. You know, we've also talked about other interactions like this one, say. Supposing we looked at a thing like that, d mu xi squared with some coefficient a. Well, we know what the dimension of this is now because we know what the dimensions of C are. So this was dimension 4, and we've got two of them. So this is going to be, this whole thing has is the dimension of dc squared is 8. So the answer had to have dimensions of mass to the 4th. So that tells us that A has to have dimensions of mass to the minus 4. And that's what we were always finding, right? That A was going like 1 over mass to the 4th. That would have been so much more convincing if I had written it right the first time, right? If you go back to your notes, you'll see that we were always getting 1 over m to the 4th. I just wrote it. I wrote the wrong thing there. I got it right there. And that's kind of why it had to be like that. But you might have said, well, so, but this is kind of a bit of a circular argument. Why couldn't I, if I had said that this was dimensionless, if I'd chosen the coefficient of this to be 1, then I would have got a different rule for what the scale, what the dimension of C was, and then I would have inferred that this would have different dimensions, right? So there's, at some point, I'm making a choice that this is a special term in the Lagrangian when I'm doing this. And what's behind that is essentially the semi-classical approximation. In the back of my mind is I'm always evaluating these things in some sort of a semi-classical expansion where I'm doing Gaussian integrals. And the assumption is that in the unperturbed part of the Lagrangian is always some sort of a free Lagrangian. It's derivative of psi, possibly plus a mass term or something quadratic in psi. And that's what's going on here is I'm using the, in the path integral, you know, if in an integral like integral dx of e to the minus lambda x squared, you know, if lambda is large, it's the, if I look at x very small, then this is order 1. If I look at x enormous compared to 1 over root lambda, then this is essentially 0. So the interesting range of the integrand, the answer depends on the integral of x from, you know, 0 up to order 1 over root lambda. But beyond that, you don't really care what the functional form here was. I'm saying this in a funny way. Yeah, let me say it this way. So if I had so let me write something a little bit more complicated here. So if I had a, let's say I had a x squared minus b x plus c x cubed or something. Or even let's just do that. And let's say we're looking at powers of, you know, x to the n. That's the kind of, this is the integral version of the kind of functional integrals we're doing when we're doing graphs. This would be the quadratic part of the action, possibly with a linear term. And then we had powers of the fields. In the saddle point approximation, where the statement is that the answer here is equal to, it's basically a power of lambda. It's 1 over root lambda, I guess, times e to the minus. Classical action would have been this thing. Let's call this thing S of X. So then the answer would have been take S and evaluate it at X classical, which means to say that I take ds dx, evaluate it at X classical, and demand that be 0. So that tells me that in this particular case, X classical would be equal to B over A. And then there's if we didn't have the x to the n, there'd be a series 1 plus order lambda, or 1 over lambda. And then if I do have these powers, then I end up with x, this is the same x to the n. So when you're doing the saddle point approximation, what's happening is that it's the point where if the overall action is large, because there's a big factor in front of it. So in our language, we really had, I shouldn't be using lambda here because this is not the lambda of our coupling constant. We had 1 over lambda. So when 1 over lambda was small, we had a big factor in front of the action. When the action is large, so let me call that something else. Let's call it zeta or something like that. Just to not be confusing. Then the important part of this integrand is the part where S is not changing by much. And I guess this would be that probably the clearer way to say that would be we're actually not doing this integral, we're doing the imaginary version of this integral. That's the path integral we really have. what's happening is that it's at the saddle point where this derivative is zero, that as you vary through that point, this is not changing much. And so what's happening is that if the action changes by a lot, if you change x by a little bit because of this big factor, the action changes by a lot. That means is that the phases are changing, oscillating a lot. And so there's a lot of cancellation going on in the sum that you're doing when you do the integral. It's the point where the phases are not changing by much. So that's the point where the SDX is zero. So you're going through a place where S is, for some reason, not oscillating very much. That's the place where everything just gets to add together and not interfere with one another. And that's dominating the answer in a way which is parameterizable in powers of one over the thing that was making the action large. That's the statement that's underlining this saddle point approximation for integrals is what's underlying our semi-classical expansion of path integrals. And I'm telling you that because, you know, it's if you want to know where the lambdas go here, it's useful to to choose your variables where I scale zeta into x so that the coefficients out here are order one. Because then rather than, so what's going to happen here is that when x is, this is going to happen if a and b are order one, the saddle point is at order one. And so in these variables, all the bigness is in the overall factor of zeta. But we could have equally well have scaled the zeta into x, in which case we would have had x would go like square root of zeta, and then b would also have a zeta in it. And in that language, which is more the language that we're getting in field theory, the issue is x is not going to necessarily be stabilized at order one, x will be stabilized at order root zeta. In much the same way that when we did the semi-classical approximation, we demanded that our fields be of order one over the square root of the coupling constant. So the size of the field that's important in the path integral when you're using a semi-classical expansion is the one for which the saddle point, the action is going through a saddle point. And it's easiest to understand where that is if you put all the large numbers into the thing that you're varying so that you don't have any hidden large numbers. And so it's useful to think about where the small numbers are in this answer to use variables where x, you've scaled zeta index. So I change this to integral du e to the I, you know, a over 2 u squared plus da da da. I'm probably making too much out of this, but because we're doing a saddle point approximation and because this is the thing that's in the saddle point, it's useful to normalize your field so that the coefficient doesn't have any small numbers in it. And that's called canonical normalization. So that's, yeah, go ahead.
Does that normalization mean that the fields are small?
No, that means that you're efficiently choosing the field so that where the saddle point happens, nothing interesting is. They're order one, is what I want to say. All the smallness is now going to be in the corrections.
Yeah, but you're just saying that we could have chosen other fields that had a different dimension.
Yeah, if you had chosen then what you would have found is that constant was appearing everywhere in your path integral systematically, because now it's a Feynman rule. So every you know, the propagators are all the inverses of this thing. So if I had a big number here, now that's in all the propagators. And so you're moving the answer is the same size, but you're moving that number into the vertices and propagators in a way that's more difficult to track. You know, the way you normally set things up is you're putting the smallness of lambda into all the interactions so that you know that you want fewer interactions, fewer vertices to make the graph dominate. And you're not so worried about how many internal lines you draw because those are all order one. But the reason you weren't worried about it was that you canonically normalized the fields. And that's kind of a convenient way to do it. You didn't have to organize things that way. You just work harder if you do it the other way. But this is the conventional choice people make because it makes explicit where the small numbers are, and they're all coming into your interactions in the semi-classical approximation. But the main thing I'm emphasizing is that at this point, I'm tying myself to the semi-classical approximation. And so if you were doing a different problem, you'd have to think through what were the important fields in your path integral. And those are the ones you want to emphasize when you're tracking where the numbers go, the small numbers go, and the dimensions go.
Can you be in a regime where, for some reason, that the two derivative quadratic terms are important? Say, like, for some reason, you know that box C would dominate the integral?
Yeah.
And then how do you...
So for an example of that would be in situations like in inflation, where you're looking outside the Hubble scale, and then inflation just stretches things out, so you get rid of all the derivatives. And so there's an interesting open question as to what, which I hope we're going to get to at the very end of the term, is how do you describe that? But that's an example of physics where the derivatives are actually becoming irrelevant because they're all being stretched out. And then each individual point is kind of not coupled very strongly to the nearby ones. And that's physically because in an expanding universe, causality, light can't travel fast enough to let this point know what the next point's doing, so they become independent. And so they start to just randomly evolve in ways that are different from what they do here because the derivatives are tying neighboring points to each other. So it can happen.
In that case, you would choose some kind of, is it smart to choose a non-canonical normalization? Would you want that box turned?
You'd want to know what the important thing was and important configurations were in the regime of interest. And in that case, that's an unsolved problem as to what the answer is. I think actually in that case, that's one of the cases where Lagrangian doesn't exist. At the very end of the class, I was hoping to get to the point where there are some situations for which the Lagrangian doesn't exist. And so that means one of the things I've said so far has to start failing. And the main thing in that particular example, I think, is that so far we're excluding states based on energy and energy is conserved. And so if I don't start with them, I can't get them back because the energy conservation forbade it. But I think cosmology outside the horizon is more like a situation where you've got a particle moving through a fluid or something. And the difference between the particle and the fluid isn't really energy. It's just that you're watching that one. And it was allowed to scatter with particles in the fluid. And it might be if an electron comes out, say I shoot an electron into a gas of electrons, an electron comes out, I don't know what was the one I shot in. And I don't really care at some level. I'm just going to want to know what the average properties are. And you can set that problem up. It's kind of similar that if you're only looking at long distance behavior and you don't care much about the details of the environment that the electron's going through, that has there's an analog of what we're doing here if you're looking at long time behavior. But it's not one for which you have an effective Lagrangian, because in that case, you don't have unitary evolution. A particle going in can scatter into the bath and it's no longer the one you're following and something else is coming out. And so that there's no unitary operator that takes a state and evolves you to another state, because the state might just disappear, you might just be absorbed or something. So there are situations where the assumption I've made that there existed a unitary evolution can fail. And those ones are interesting, but the approach we're taking has to change at some point. So I think that particular example I gave you where the derivatives are not important is one of those examples. So it's not really true that you'd be talking about Lagrangian there so much. But it'll depend on the physical question that you're asking. Okay, so I've been flogging this probably for too long. So singling this guy out is because we're singling out the terms in the unperturbed Lagrangian and making them have no hidden dimensions. And then the dimensions will be explicitly, because we're trying to track the m's. If we had chosen to make this order one and put the m's into this, we could do that, but our Feynman rules the m's are gonna now appear in propagators rather than vertices, and it'll be more difficult to track. But you can go through the exercise and you'll see that you'll get the same answer. It's just gonna be harder to track things. The way I'm gonna organize it, the m's will all explicitly come to you as 1/m's rather than appearing to come to you as m's, which are then disappearing in graphs. So it's a conventional choice, and it just makes the counting of m's easy when m is large, if you're convinced that this is the term that's dominating. Okay, so given that, now what we can do is you can kind of see what's going to happen now. That if the rules are that I'm supposed to build polynomials in fields and polynomials in derivatives, and because the derivatives have positive dimension and powers of energy, so they're energy to a positive power, and the fields also are energies to a positive power, and the answer has a fixed dimension, the more complicated the thing is I write down, the more fields and derivatives it has, the more I'm going to have to compensate by having a coefficient which has got inverse powers of energy as its dimensions. And so if those inverse powers of energy are in practice coming to us as powers of the heavy mass scale, m, the further we go down, the more fields and derivatives we add, the more 1/m's we had. And so if we're only interested in working to some fixed order in 1/m, eventually we can stop. And that's why this is a useful way to organize things, is that we don't have to write down derivative squared, derivative of the cubed, and derivative of the 18th power. Because the fields involved and the derivatives have a positive dimension and powers of energy, and this has got a fixed dimension, there's a finite number of terms which involve positive powers of energy in the coefficients or dimensionless powers. And then after that, the infinite number of terms that go beyond that are all suppressed by some power of 1/m. And the more farther down you go with more fields and derivatives, the more 1/m's you have. That's kind of the key thing. So the important point is that fields and derivatives have positive as opposed to non-negative dimension. So more complicated interactions have coefficients with more negative dimension. And so because of that, because the dimension for the coefficients is ultimately coming from this heavy scale M, there's involved more and more powers of 1 over M. And so let's just take some examples. So we're not always going to talk about scalar fields. We're going to be interested in QED and electrons and fermions. So let's kind of take some examples just to identify how these powers are going. So let me write down some different Lagrangians. So let's take QED as an example. So the Lagrangian for QED is minus, you know, psi bar d slash, or say it's gamma mu d mu plus m psi minus 1/4 f mu nu. And so, and let's say we had a charged spinless particle too. So let's write down minus, you know, d mu phi star d mu phi. We might have had potential energy V of phi star phi. And we might have a coupling between phi and psi. So let's say we have psi bar, some matrix, call it gamma psi times phi, and possibly complex conjugates. So I've got coefficients here. Y is a coefficient, M is a coefficient, and then V might, you know, V would be, I could imagine V is V naught plus A phi star phi plus B phi star phi squared, and so on. You know, say C phi star phi to the fourth, or cubed, I guess. And these derivatives, so d mu of psi would be partial mu of psi minus I times some charge, a mu psi. And the derivative for the scalar field would be something like that. It'd be partial mu phi minus I e times some numerical charge. Let's just give it a different charge. Say we're using units where the charge of the fermion is 1. And F is the field strength. For the gauge potential. And if you're not, if you've never seen the QED Lagrangian, you don't need to care. Just take these as definitions. And the question I want to ask is, what are the dimensions of the fields? And what are the dimensions of these coefficients in the Lagrangian? Just because it's an example we're going to come back to, and it's an important example, and it kind of forces me to say what the dimension of something besides a scalar is. All right, so we're going to imagine again that we're going to be semi-classically expanding things. And so that means the quadratic things in the fields will be the things that we're going to imagine are bigger than other things in the path integral in the action. And that will only be a good approximation if there's a small number in the problem, which I'm not even going to try and address. I'm going to say that supposing it were true that the quadratic part of the action is the important part, and in particular the kinetic part. So I'm going to focus on the things where in here there's a derivative. So psi bar derivative psi is what you would call the kinetic term for the fermion. And here, we've got two derivatives. That's what we would have called the kinetic term for the scalar field. And in here, there's derivatives because this is derivative of A, and I should think of A as being the field that we're interested in. And so this is something with two derivatives. And I've already canonically normalized it. So the fact that I wrote 1 here and 1/4 here and 1 here was a conventional choice, and it was chosen to make these things with the derivatives be dimensionless, and the numerical factor is a conventional factor, which, and I've given you the conventional one. So that choice will be, I'm implicitly assuming that the semi-classical approximation with quadratic things dominating is going to be important, and that dictates the dimensions of these fields. So we already know what happens for phi. We know that, again, the Lagrangian has dimensions of energy to the fourth. The derivatives have dimensions of energy. And so that means that if that has dimensions of energy, this has to also have dimensions of energy. And similarly here, whatever dimension of psi is, here's a dimension of energy. So that means this also has to have dimensions of energy. So we know that the Lagrangian is dimension 4. The derivatives have dimension 1. So that means that combination EA has dimension 1 as well. In order to make the covariant derivative of psi have consistent dimension. And then if I look at the scalar, that means that the number Q has to be dimensionless because it already has a factor of E. I've written it this way with EA already explicit. The dimensions of the fields we'll identify by taking the terms in Lagrangian that have just numerical factors, which is the canonical where I've canonically normalized. So we already know that the minus d mu phi star d mu phi piece that lives in the capital D mu phi star d mu phi tells us that the dimension of phi has to be 1, because that's exactly the same as what we had for xi over there. Similarly, the piece minus psi bar gamma mu derivative psi, the gamma matrices are just numbers, right? It's just 4x4 numbers. That's got dimensions of mass or energy. And the whole thing had to be energy to the fourth. So these guys have to together give us energy cubed. So that says that for the fermion in quantum electrodynamics, it's got dimensions of energy to the 3/2. And then for the electromagnetic field, we know that minus 1/4 F mu nu includes things like minus 1/4, d mu A nu, d mu A nu, plus other terms. And so again, this is very much like this now, that the derivatives each give us a power of energy. So the fields A have to give us powers of energy as well, one power of energy each to give us energy to the fourth. So A mu has to be energy. So then that tells us that that the electric charge is dimensionless in 4 dimensions. And this is an example of something that would change if we had not been in 4 dimensions. But in 4 dimensions, 4 space-time dimensions, the electric charge is dimensionless. And what else do we not know now? So now we can go through and figure out what the dimensions of everybody else are. So if we look at the dimensions here, this parameter m, we know that this is mass energy to the fourth. This is size, 2 psi's together is energy cubed. So this has to have the same dimension as d does. So it has to have dimensions of energy. That's good. It was supposed to be physically the mass. If we'd actually found the spectrum of that theory, this would have been the mass of the fermion that we're talking about. So it's good that it has dimensions of energy. What else we have here? So in the potential energy, V naught has to have the same dimensions as the Lagrangian. So that's energy to the fourth. Phi star phi has dimensions of energy squared. So A has to have dimensions of energy squared. So that's the thing that would have been the mass squared when we were looking at the toy model. The coefficient here was what turned into the mass squared. That's one way to see why it was the square of a mass. This has got 4 powers of energy in it. So that means that's dimensionless, the coefficient B. And that's what would have been lambda in our toy model. So that's kind of why it was dimensionless. Powers of lambda were sensible to organize because it was dimensionless. Here we've got energy to the 6th. And so that means this must be 1 over an energy squared. If we ever found something like this, that would be 1 over the mr squared appearing there. So we see that the V having dimension 4 means that V naught is dimension 4. A is dimension 2. B is dimension 0, C is dimension minus 2. And the farther down we went in the Taylor expansion in powers of phi, the more negative the coefficients are in powers of energy. And the only thing we haven't talked about yet is this guy here. So this is what you would call a Yukawa coupling. This gamma, I didn't tell you what it was. It's some Dirac matrix, so it's a dimensionless thing. It could be the unit matrix, it could be other things, but it's if it was the unit matrix, there's no dimensions there. 2 fermions were dimensions of energy cubed. 1 scalar was dimensions of energy. And so this together has got dimensions of energy to the fourth, so this has to be dimensionless. So y is dimensionless. But we could have written down in principle, we could have imagined, if we can write this down, we could have also written down something like psi bar, let's say call it coefficient z, psi bar psi phi star phi phi. In this case, this would have been dimensions of energy cubed. This is also energy cubed, so this is energy to the sixth. So this has to be, z would have to be then have dimensions of energy to the minus two, and so on. So the more and more complicated interactions you write down, the more the coefficients are suppressed by powers of minus two. And what I wrote down for you was the standard quantum electrodynamics for scalars and for fermions. And what was special, you notice, about that was that all these coupling constants, B, normally you would have stopped here, as we did in the toy model. V naught, A, B, Y, and E, and M, they're all non-negative powers of energy. So notice that that in QED, which is defined to be the thing involving V naught, A, B, C, Y, and E, and M. These are the couplings that are in that problem. All couplings satisfy the dimension of the coupling is equal to P, which is greater than or equal to zero. And so that, in this language of where the heavy masses go, if you thought of this as coming to us by integrating out some heavy thing, these are the ones that are not suppressed by that heavy mass. And the things that we're not writing down traditionally, like this one or like this one, these would have been suppressed by heavy mass. And so this is kind of the beginnings of an understanding as to why the interesting part of this Lagrangian might have been what people normally write down and not these other things that they don't normally write down. It's because the things that people normally write down are the only things you could write down with those particles and the symmetries of that problem, for which the coefficients are not suppressed by a new mass, a new heavy mass, if it existed. No, you're right. Thank you. I hope I have some change. there's a dime in here somewhere. There. Thanks. So that's the modern picture. This statement that the couplings, if you have all the possible interactions that are consistent with the field content and the symmetries, and if all the coefficients that you get in your Lagrangian, so you've written them all possible ones that you could have written down, and if they all have dimensions of energy to a non-negative power, that's what you mean by renormalizable theory. What is smaller than A, sorry?
B.
It's
still, because you're saying that the positive power, for example, or the negative power means it goes like 1 over mr squared.
Right.
The positive power means it goes like mr squared, right? Because that's the
square. Right.
That means that.
Yeah, so you're saying that if I thought of this as being implicit in what I'm saying is that whenever I have a power of energy, I should think of that as being this big energy, this big mr, right? So you're saying that this would have been going like mr to the fourth, that should have been going like mr squared. This could go like log mr or something, but it's some dimensionless thing. So your intuition, and that's right, that your intuition should be that these things are huge if mr is huge, and these dimensionless ones are just whatever they are. Yeah, so the issue that you're rightly focusing on is a naturalness issue. So if someone said that this was the size of these coefficients, what you really would have said is that the scalar that I wrote down is actually not light, it's actually heavy. Because this A is going to turn into the mass of that scalar if we had done semi-classical calculation. So I would have chosen the wrong degrees of freedom in this problem. I would have said that where that thought goes, the one that you're following, is that implicitly what I was doing here was writing down something in a Wilson action where I've got rid of the heavy things, and I was wrong to keep this one because it's not heavy. Because it is heavy, it's not light. And so the question for me would then be to say, well, if I've given you this theory, for some reason I have to give you, for this to be light, I have to have adjusted this A. This A has to come to me smaller than this scale MR for some reason. And I have to explain that to you. But if I don't, then you're right, then I should have generically not expected that particle to be here. And that's the naturalness issue, that's the hierarchy problem. Things that go like positive powers of heavy masses, if they're allowed to be generated, they will be generated and they'll be enormous. And so the question is, if that screws up anything you thought was going on at low energies, you should be worried about it. So in the standard model, where there's a Higgs particle and the Higgs particle has got a mass smaller than the Planck scale, people worry about that, because if there was physics at some higher scale and you integrated it out, we should have got a Higgs mass which was huge. And so then why was the Higgs light? And that's the rule normally, is that the reason that you don't find, people say that you don't have elementary scalars in the world, that's why, is that in nature, that's normally what happens. If you did have a spinless degree of freedom, when you figure out what its energy is, it's always high, because in quantum mechanics, you know, basically quantum mechanics says is if it's allowed, it's compulsory, because if you tried to not have it, quantum corrections will give it back to you. And so it's actually unusual to find scalars that are light, precisely because these kind of terms would make them not be light. You could say the same thing with this. You know, why wasn't that big? And the difference between fermions and scalars is that there's a symmetry. If this had been zero, and I ask, what do quantum corrections do? It stays zero because there's a symmetry. There's actually more symmetry in the problem when the mass is not here than there is when the mass is there. So that means that symmetry, if the world at high energies happened to obey that symmetry, it would not give this term because the symmetry forbids it. And the rule was I had to write down everything that had the fields that had all the fields that were light and obeyed all the symmetries of the problem. So if there's a symmetry that forbids a mass and the high energy physics respects that symmetry, then I won't get that mass because it was forbidden by the symmetry. But if there's no symmetry that forbids it, then I should expect to see it. And so fermions, you can forbid a symmetry with a mass with a symmetry. So that's why we're not surprised to find fermions that are light sometimes. But for scalars, there's not a lot of symmetries that make this. Typically, like any unitary kind of transformation will believe this invariant. So it's the hard thing is to find a symmetry that makes a scalar mass be zero. One such symmetry, the toy model had. If I have a symmetry where C equals to C plus a constant, so the scalar doesn't appear in the potential at all, that would work, right? So in our toy model case, for us, for that case, A, B, and C were all zero because we had a symmetry in that problem which said that C equals to C plus constant, and that would have forbidden this from being anything except for a constant.
But the answer is that A will most of the time not be there, actually, even though you found that it's a positive power.
It's not that A won't be there, it's that phi won't be there. Because if you give me the full theory and I just generically look at its spectrum, what I'm going to find is that the scalars are never going to be light. If I assume that they were light, and then I calculate what the results are from integrating out the heavy physics to get the Wilson action, I'll get contributions that will make them heavy again.
Yeah, so once you find that A has dimension 2, you're like, no, that means that it was never there.
If it's there, I have to explain why it's small.
Yeah, so unless there's some symmetry.
Right. So in the absence of a symmetry, I should not expect the things that are positive powers of mass to be there, be generated by integrating out heavy physics. Because if I did, it would be huge. And so that's also true for V0. And normally people don't worry about that because not much depends on V0. But if you're doing gravity, gravity sees this. This is the cosmological constant problem. It should be getting a contribution which is as big as m to the fourth for every particle you've got in your high energy theory. So the biggest ones are the most important ones. And it's measured to be much, much smaller than all the masses we know about in nature. So, except maybe for neutrinos. So something needs explaining there. So the thing that you're worried about is a worry. Whenever you have a positive power of mass in a low energy theory, that should set warning flags off. That there's something that needs explaining as to why that thing's there, because generically it's saying that the thing you thought was light was actually not light. You should not have had it in your low energy theory. Unless there's a symmetry that forbids it. It's there, yeah. The question is, if you have a symmetry, if you have the symmetry that forbids it, if it's an exact symmetry, then it's not there, then it's a massless thing. But then, if the symmetry is not there, the question is, are you close to a symmetry limit? So if you have this, supposing the symmetry is actually, you have a system where you don't have the symmetry, but the only thing that breaks the symmetry in the full theory is a small term, then it might be that you're perturbatively close to a symmetric point, and then this thing will be proportional to that small thing, whatever it is. But you'd understand that, because if I turn it off, I'd say, oh, there's more symmetry now than there is in the full theory. The things that break the symmetry can change things that, anything that, if I start with a symmetric theory, I will never generate non-symmetric terms in the Lagrangian, unless there's an anomaly, which means there wasn't a symmetry. So that means that if all the things in my theory that break the symmetry are small, that smallness will be preserved because the corrections to this things that break the symmetry are all involving the thing that broke the symmetry, and so they all have this small thing in it. So if I have something which is where there's more symmetry when I turn this parameter off, that means that the corrections to that parameter have to always involve that parameter because that's the only thing that broke the symmetry. So if all the things that break a symmetry are small, then that'll be a consistent picture at low energies, because that's what the high energy theory will have to give you. To the small thing, yeah. And so the question is how small. So it has to be small enough to make that epsilon times MR small enough that it's in the low energy theory. But in any case you see that, you should be asking, so now what explained why this was actually small, even though it could have been proportional to a big mass? And if you go through the list of all the problems of particle physics, that's the list. You know, this is the cosmological constant problem, this is the hierarchy problem. This was a problem before people understood it better, but this is the explanation as to why the standard model is mostly fermions. The question is not why is the Planck scale high or why is the whatever the other physics is high. The question is why is the standard model light? And we understand in the standard model it's light because the gauge interactions of the standard model are the ones that actually make this small. So you can't get a mass until you break it with the Higgs. And so that's why the Higgs mechanism was important. If we were allowed to write down a mass for the standard model particles that didn't care about the Higgs, they would have all had huge masses. So we shouldn't be surprised to find that all the ones we see at low energies have the property that they get a mass only when the Higgs breaks the symmetry. Because any ones that didn't have that property, we wouldn't see because they'd be heavy. And the same thing for the gauge bosons, that the masses for the gauge bosons, which are hidden in here, they're only there when you break the symmetry. And so if the physics at high energies preserves that symmetry, then you understand why these things would be light. As long as you understand why the Higgs VEV is small, but that's the question of why this is small. You had a question?
Same logic could apply to those scalar fields and could end up having.
In the standard model, it all goes back to this, because in the standard model, everything's dimensionless except for these two parameters here. So those are the two that people always focus on. And then the masses for everybody else are proportional to the expectation values of the scalars, which ultimately came from the minimizing the potential, and that came from this parameter. So you understand why everybody in the standard model is lighter than 100 GeV as soon as you know why this coefficient is 100 GeV. But the question is, why is that coefficient 100 GeV? Yeah, I think so. It's like there's proposals for how. So the question would be, the reason that's an interesting question is that tells you something. It's a clue for what the heavy physics is, because if you can find a symmetry that makes this small, then that means probably the heavy physics has that symmetry, and so that means that's going to organize how you think what your guess is what the heavy physics is, and so supersymmetry is an example of something. Supersymmetry ties a scalar to a fermion, and so you have a symmetry that kills this mass, supersymmetry will then kill this one too. So the logic of supersymmetry in the hierarchy problem is that we knew how to make the fermion masses small, so if we had a symmetry that tied the scalars to the fermions, then that would make the scalar masses small too. And so that's kind of the logic that takes you to supersymmetry. But there are other logic, you could also, maybe this is like the Goldstone boson, maybe it's something that's close to a shift symmetry. And you can kind of organize everything that people do in particle physics as being ways in which you try and make this be related to something else through a symmetry, essentially.
So I've seen the QED Lagrangian before, but it didn't have any Yukawa couplings or...
Oh, because you don't normally write the scalars down, right?
Right, you know, don't
normally. If you had pions, say, in QED, which you don't normally do, but you could have put them in, then those would be charged scalars, and then you could have had something like this, a couple, say, nucleons to pions. So I ran over there, sorry. You have the dimensional analysis point, and now the next part of the question is, once we know that we have all these interactions and they're suppressed by powers of 1 over m or whatever they are, the next thing we want to ask is, we stick it into a graph, where do the m's go in the answer? Because at the end of the day, the goal is we're going to have an observable, we calculate the observable using the effective interactions to some order in 1 over m, and then we compare that to the calculation of the full theory, and that's how we read off what these coefficients are. So we have to know which graphs to do. So that's the power counting part of the story, is that once you know the Lagrangian, how do you find the graphs that you're supposed to stick it in to get observables to some fixed order in 1 over m?